When dawn came up the next day, God appointed a worm that attacked the plant so that it withered. When the sun rose, God appointed a scorching east wind, and the sun beat down on the head of Jonah so that he was faint, and he asked for he might die and said, "It is better for me to die than to live." But God said to Jonah, "Do you do well to be angry for the plant?" And he said, "Yes, I do well to be angry, angry enough to die." And the Lord said, "You pity the plant for which you did not labor, nor did you make it grow, which came into being in a night, and it perished in a night. And should not I pity Nineveh, the great city, in which there are more than 120,000 persons who do not know their right hand from their left, and also much cattle?" Someone has said that as soon as we decide to measure something, we become slaves to it. But how do we determine success? We look at the results, and oftentimes, like it or not, we measure the results to determine if we've been successful. We keep track, we study, we analyze, we crunch the numbers. How many winning seasons does this team have? What's his batting average? What are her grades like? Have you seen the poll numbers? What about my 401k? How's that looking? What are the financial results? How many records did he sell? How many books did she sell? And on it goes. We look at the results to determine if we're successful, and churches are any different. Really. We look at numbers. Each year, the diocese, the province, they want a whole list of numbers. How many people did you baptize? How many were confirmed? How many were, how many burials? How many weddings? Numbers are important. And everybody, well, there's probably only maybe one other person in here that knows what an ASA is, right? How important an ASA is. And you're known by your ASA, right? Your average Sunday attendance. And preachers are the same, really, if we're honest. When we preach sermons, we want results. We want to know that it mattered, that it made a difference. And that's why Jonah chapter 4 is so perplexing, isn't it? So perplexing, because I'm not aware of any preacher anywhere or at any point in history that got the results that Jonah did. I mean, wow. The whole city turned and changed direction. They repented. Their lives were different. Everyone, top to bottom. From the throne, from the palace, even to the cow pasture. Okay? 100% positive results from his preaching. Wow. He should be doing cartwheels. But not Jonah. He's mad. He's angry. So far, this is the fourth Sunday, and so far we've seen Jonah as the one who is running, the prophet who is running, and then he's sleeping, right? And then he's drowning. And in chapter 2, he's praying. In chapter 3, he's preaching. And now in chapter 4, he's sulking. He's the sulking servant. To sulk, the dictionary says, to remain silent or hold oneself aloof in a sullen, ill-humored, or offended mood. He's sulking. And we come to chapter 4, what is the most significant chapter in the book of Jonah. The most significant, and probably the most overlooked. Most people, even a stranger out in the street, can tell you about Jonah and the whale and the whole story. And there may be a few more who can tell you about chapter 3 and the preaching and the repentance of Nineveh. But I doubt that very few ever think of chapter 4. The real purpose of the book. The real meaning of the story. Now, there are four movements in the book of Jonah. There are four chapters. There are four movements. Jonah and the storm, he's running. Jonah and the fish, he's praying. Jonah and the city, he's preaching. And now in chapter 4, it's Jonah and the Lord, and he's learning. He's learning. And we noted that the main theme of the book, the overarching purpose of the book of Jonah, is God's boundless mercy, his boundless compassion. We saw mercy to the mariners, the sailors, and then we saw mercy to Jonah. Last week it was mercy to Nineveh, and this week it's mercy to, and I got it wrong at first when I was thinking about it. I thought, it's mercy to the world, right? But it's not. It's mercy to me. To me. To you. And we'll get to that point, but for now, let's get back to Jonah. He had tremendous results. He's the guy that played at Carnegie Hall and got a standing ovation, man. Wow. And yet he says that the word, he was displeased. It displeased Jonah exceedingly, and he was angry. That word displeased is an interesting word. The Hebrew word is used 9 times in the book of Jonah. And it's translated many times as evil, disaster, displeased. And so a literal reading of that verse would be this. It was evil to Jonah what the Lord had done. It was evil. Now that's strong language, right? Very strong. You see, for Jonah, it was okay that God showed mercy to Israel. I mean, you remember back in Exodus 32, and Moses went to the mountain, and they all built a golden calf, and Moses came down, and God was furious, and he was ready to, he said, just get out of the way, Moses. I'm going to wipe them out and get a new people. We'll start again. And Moses has to plead with God, change your mind. Change your mind. And God does. It says that God relents. He turns. He changes his mind. That was good with Jonah. And it was good with Jonah when he disobeyed and he ran away and he ended up in a storm and then in the belly of the fish. But Jonah had no problem with God's mercy then. But now, this is too much for him. And so, the book of Jonah comes to a close with a dialogue. The only time that we have this dialogue, this conversation between God and Jonah. And it ends in one of the strangest endings in all of Scripture. Well, Jonah's problem was that he did not understand God's mercy. He did not understand God's grace. He didn't really grasp who God is. And there's 3 things, very briefly, I want to point to you about God and his mercy and his grace. The first one is that God, he's the God who is patient. Now, don't you wonder why God didn't say here in chapter 4, I mean, after everything that happened, you know, why didn't God say, you know what, Jonah, I've had enough of this. I mean, really? You know, really? You disobeyed me, you ran, I showed mercy to you, you went to Nineveh, you were the most successful preacher in all of history, okay? You turned, some of the worst people on the planet turned and changed their life because of your work. And now you're mad. You know what? I've had it with you. You decided to sleep through a calamity, and you've experienced my mercy, and you're ungrateful. You're just like the servant of Matthew 18. You remember, we read about that a few weeks ago, when the guys brought in and he owed all this debt to his master. And he deserved to be hauled out, to be put in prison, and he was forgiven. But he was so ungrateful that he went out to the people that owed him money, and he would not forgive them. He would not show mercy to them. That's Jonah. And that's most of us would have said at this point with Jonah, enough is enough. I've lost my patience with you. But God takes him aside He takes him aside for a conversation to teach him a lesson. There's no storm this time, no wrath, just a lesson, an object lesson. It's a very tender moment. In 1929, on New Year's Day, the Rose Bowl was played between Georgia Tech and the University of California. During the first half, a guy by the name of Roy Rivals, he recovered a fumble for the University of California, and he ran 65 yards in the wrong direction. In the wrong direction. And one of his teammates tackled him right before he went across the goal line. But still, Georgia Tech was able to score a safety. Well, we get to halftime, and most of us can imagine, especially back then, what a halftime was like, and with those coaches, and the anger, and what would go on in a locker room in halftime, especially if you're the guy that did something like that. The coach gathered the team. Rigels sat in a corner with a blanket over his head, and he wept. He cried. And when the coach was finished, he says, "Well, I just want you to know that the people who started the first half will also start the second half." The team got up and got on the field, and Rigels stayed behind. And the coach says, "Come on, you're on. You're going to play." He says, "I can't. I've embarrassed myself. I've embarrassed my team. I'm a laughingstock. I can't do it." And the coach said, "You can do it. Go back out there." The Georgia Tech team said that they had never, ever saw a man play football like Roy Rivals played football that second half. God is patient. He's the God who is not only patient, but he's the God who weeps. "You pity the plant. Should I not pity Nineveh?" And that's another interesting word in the Hebrew language that our English doesn't quite get it. It means compassion. It means to grieve over someone or something to the point where your heart is broken, to the point where you break down and weep. As in Genesis chapter 6, verse 6, when God tells Noah, "I've seen the evil that these people were doing, that the world is doing, and my heart," God says, "my heart is filled with pain." Your heart was filled with pain and you wept over a gourd. It was very personal, this gourd that you had nothing to do with. It was very close to your heart. "But these people were close to my heart and I weep for them." He's the God who weeps. He's also the God who is generous. How most historians and how people then look at Nineveh, the city of the Assyrians, we've noted over the past couple weeks, they were known for their brutality. Paintings of them are depicted in various places, of their things that you would not show a child, of the tortures that the Assyrians committed to people. These were really bad people. Really bad. And yet, God sees them as those who do not know their right hand from their left. An idiom, right? An idiom, figure speech. They do not know their right hand from their left. He sees them as spiritually blind. They've lost their way. They don't have a clue about the source of their problems or what to do about them. And God is generous in his thinking of these people. Way more generous than Jonah. That is the grace of God. That is the mercy of God. And when we get to the end of the book, it ends with this question. Should I not have been shown them pity? Should I not have wept over them and showed them compassion? And that's the end. And we're left wondering, what happened to Jonah? Where did he go? Did he change his mind? What happened? We don't know. Because it's an open end. you and I today are left at the end of this story. We are left in the presence of God asking, do I understand God's mercy? How do I respond to it? Is there anything more important in life to me than God's mercy, than God's grace to the world? Do we understand how he really is? That he's patient, that he weeps, that he's generous. And perhaps the only way to really comprehend it is to be grasped by it, to be grasped by his grace ourselves. In the name of the Father and the Son.